This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood.
Good evening. You're listening to Heartstock Radio. I'm Carol Murphy, your host. We have a great program. We will introduce our guest here shortly. Remember that we're on Facebook. You can message us there or email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com. This evening, our guest is Michael Larson, founder of APIS Communication Science. In just a moment, Michael will be back and introduce herself, tell you what she's up to. We'll be right back. Thank you for being here. This is Heartstock. This is Heartstock Radio. I'm Carol Murphy, your host. Today we have Micah Larson. Hi, Micah.
Hi, Carol. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for being with us. So tell our listeners who you are and what you do.
So I am a persuasion scientist and a consultant at my company, which is called APIS Communication Science, which means that my job is to help people learn to be more persuasive. And my background is in research, but I decided to leave academia to become an entrepreneur.
So we always like to start out with a little bit about your life's journey and what led you down this path that you're on. It's always so fascinating to me. Was there something that happened in your life that kind of made you decide to go into this?
Yes. While I was in college, I actually studied abroad in Ghana in West Africa and was teaching first grade there and was able to leave a lot of my money behind to start a scholarship fund for my students. But when I came back, I had all these ambitions to raise all this money for my parents' friends and people that I knew. And I learned very quickly that I wasn't doing a great job at that. I wasn't being very persuasive. And 10 years ago, I would never have thought now that I'd be running a business like this. In fact, one of my goals was to work as a data analyst in the CIA. But life took twists and turns. And when I was in grad school, as you may know, grad students don't make much money. So while in school, I had to get a couple other jobs to pay the bills. And one of them was as a director of communications in the Texas House of Representatives. And while I was there and I was studying persuasion in grad school, I got to see what it was like when we can persuade on a massive scale. And I ended up being very inspired by that.
Okay. Well, I have to be honest. When it comes to persuasion, especially when it's tied to marketing, sometimes it feels a little smarmy, for lack of a better word. Can you help us understand why this is so important and how do we persuade people ethically?
Those are great questions and they're ones I love to answer. So first, persuasion science is about learning the ways we can change people's attitudes. So we all have attitudes about everything we've ever encountered in our lives. And our attitudes are what determine our behaviors and what we do. So if we have, for example, really strong attitudes toward the outdoors, we're probably more likely to recycle and conserve water. So that's persuasion science. And when we apply it, it's to change people's attitudes and make it more likely that they will take certain actions like voting or not driving drunk or investing in a small business or something like that. And so the tactics, the persuasion tactics I teach my clients are subtle psychological tools that change attitudes. And I work with a lot of people in sales and marketing because they get tired of using the same old methods and they want to know how they can be more efficient and often more ethical. So one of the most important things to know about persuasion is that it's different from coercion. And people often get those two things confused. So when you coerce someone, you force him or her to do something. But when you persuade, people have the opportunity to say no, because they always have free will.
I love that you're a woman in STEM. It sounds like you've always kind of been oriented towards science and math. Would you say that's true?
I have not been oriented toward math so much until I really learned how we can use science to really change the world and use it in a psychological sense.
So when you were younger, tell us a little bit about like where you grew up, and you're living in Missoula right now, right?
I am. I love Missoula, but it took me a while to get here. I'm from outside of St. Louis, and I grew up on a horse farm. And
What kind of horses? I have to ask you. I'm sorry.
If people in Montana love to know that. Quarter horses and Morgans.
Of course.
Yeah.
The Great American Quarter Horse.
Exactly. That's my favorite. Then I ended up in Texas, another great horse place. Grad school, and then in Wyoming, and now I'm here. I think I'm done moving. I love Missoula.
So Missoula has stolen your heart.
Absolutely. Yeah, the people here are fantastic.
And what brought you to Missoula?
My husband and I were living in Casper, Wyoming, and we didn't think that that was going to be our forever home. And he drove through Missoula and said, "You've got to come see this place." And I think it took me about 2 hours to decide that that was where I wanted to spend the next chapter of our lives. And we made it happen. He found a job and I moved my company.
So let's talk about your influences as you became a communication scientist. Can you talk about that a little bit? Good and bad. What were some of your aha moments?
Yes. So when I was teaching public speaking at a private university in Texas, I kind of decided that academia wasn't for me. But while I was there, I was really lucky to have an amazing mentor, Dr. Adam Richards, and he's an award-winning persuasion researcher from this little tiny field that we work in. I think we could all fit in a small conference room together. And Adam actually used to work for the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. And so he used persuasion on this massive scale to try to get people to do things like stop smoking or get vaccinated. So learning that the power of persuasion has on that level was such a huge influence for me. And he taught me the drive that I have now to use science to help people.
Mm-hmm. And then you kind of went on to form your own company. What was that evolution like? Did you always know that you were an entrepreneur at heart? It sounds like maybe that was something that came up when you were in academia.
Yes, I wanted to work in the CIA. And then I think during that time, I realized that I needed something that was a little bit more independent. And I come from a long family tradition of entrepreneurs. So it seemed like a good fit. I think I have 10 cousins and maybe half of us are entrepreneurs. So it's...
That's amazing.
I think I come by it naturally.
I think all my cousins think I'm crazy. What is she doing? And is there a 401k involved in that?
It's a hard road, but a worthy one.
Yes, I agree 100%. So tell us about your progression as an entrepreneur and what was the thought process like and the journey forming APIS?
Well, when I was working in the Texas House of Representatives, for one example, I was a speechwriter. And so a lot of times my job was to persuade people on this big scale to support a measure. And one of the most memorable times was when there was a woman who had a pulmonary embolism, and she was being kept on life support in the hospital, and she was pregnant. And so there was a big back and forth political debate about what to do about this. And part of my job was to help change people's opinions about this specific issue. And it was remarkable to see what persuasion science could do in that capacity. And that's not what I wanted to work on, that specific issue, anymore as an entrepreneur, but I could see how we could move the world in the right direction, whether it's helping engage people in nonprofits or to protect the environment, et cetera.
Very cool. So did you start APIS before you moved to Missoula? It sounds like
I did. Mm-hmm. Yes, I started in Texas and then was in Wyoming for a few years and now here in Montana.
I really like to delve in more to the whole science of persuasion. And I'm hoping by the end of the show that our listeners will really understand what you mean specifically about the science. Why, I mean, is it truly a science? And what does the research and the data show about the right way to go about it?
Yeah, so those are some big questions.
Yes.
A science is a methodical way of acquiring knowledge. So it's testing things and then figuring out, does this support my hypothesis or not? And so, yes, persuasion science is a science. I come from the communication science world. And so in persuasion, of neuroscience and linguistics and evolutionary psychology, all those fields to figure out what are the best ways to change people's attitudes.
Sounds very complicated.
It is, but my job is to make it simple for other people. I'll do all the hard work.
Tell us a little bit more about what science tells us in regards to how our minds work when it comes to changing our minds. The other day, I met a gentleman that I had never ran into this before, but he went from the far left to the far right politically. And I was like, holy cats, how does that happen? And I'm sure you deal with this a lot and have dealt with it in the past. How is it that someone swings from one opinion to another, you know, even if they're kind of centric, let alone going from one extreme to another? I'm sure there were a lot of influences in his life that made that happen, and a lot of psychology that maybe even he didn't understand. Help us see this.
That is really interesting and quite unusual, particularly in these political times that we are living in. People tend to get more entrenched in their opinions rather than change them. An interesting thing about persuasion is often that the more people try to persuade us, the less we are willing to be persuaded. So good persuasion really has to be completely subtle, or as I call it, invisible. It has to blend seamlessly into conversations or marketing in order to really work well. So it's kind of the opposite of like hardcore aggressive sales tactics. And these days, there are so many demands on our attention. So the things that really cut through all of that noise and might have contributed to this particular person's attitudes changing so much are people who are really strong authority figures or issues that were particularly relevant to him. We tend to focus our attention most closely on things that are really relevant and have big effects on our lives, and people who tend to seem like they're authority figures or they have a lot of knowledge and expertise. In fact, our brains don't even go through decision-making processes when we get information from people we consider authorities. We kind of just defer to them.
That's fascinating. So aside from authority figures, which explains a lot about what happens politically, and we can look at all kinds of events, historically speaking, where strong authority figures really had a huge influence, both in a negative way, and the potential is there for positive as well. So what else besides just the sheer fact that somebody has a very strong personality and comes off as an authority, what else is pertinent to the way our minds work when it comes to persuasion?
Yeah, so we tend to also pay attention to things that are self-relevant cues, by which I mean things that remind us of ourselves or things in our past. For example, we tend to like people more when we think that they are similar to us. And this is all because our brains really like to work as efficiently as possible. Our brains always try to take the easy way out to solve problems. So if we're trying to figure out, should I agree with this person? Should I say yes to this person? It's much more efficient to go about thinking through that problem by evaluating whether this person is similar to me, rather than thinking, oh, here are all the pros and cons of this particular issue. And so that's kind of a shortcut in our thinking that we use. For example, I went into a client's office a few months ago and noticed that he had a St. Louis Rams helmet, a football helmet, in a glass case in his office, which is great because I'm from St. Louis and we got to strike up a conversation about that. And so later on, when I made a request of him, it likely increased the chances that he would have said yes to me. And he did, because he saw me as more similar to him.
So we're at that midway point. We're going to take a quick music break. And when we come back, I'd really like to talk more about outliers and innovation, because oftentimes as entrepreneurs and innovators, we're trying to convince people to adapt things that really are very unfamiliar to them. So maybe when we come back, we can talk about that.
Sure.
How's that sound? Okay.
Great.
This is Heartstock Radio, and we're speaking with Micah Larson. We'll be right back. Good evening. This is Heartstock, and I'm Carol Murphy. You're listening to Heartstock Radio, and we're talking with Micah Larson. Hi, Micah, again.
Hi, Carol.
So let's talk about that a little bit. When we're innovating and we're creating something that's totally new, you know, we've got the authority figure, and kind of it sounds like our laziness tendency almost to go with what's similar and what is familiar. How do we persuade when we have something that is kind of out of the box, but yet very needed, that will help, you know, society or the planet at large?
You know, just as much as we tend to like to take shortcuts and say yes to things that are familiar to us, we're also attracted to new and novel ideas. And so we see a lot of value in new as well. So outliers like Elon Musk, for example, he's presenting our world with all of these new and fantastic opportunities to drive Tesla cars and not have to fill up at the gas pump anymore, et cetera. We tend to really like the idea of those things as well. And so there are these kind of two opposing forces, being familiarity and novelty. And when we're willing to take risks, we're more likely to go with something novel over something familiar.
So let's talk a little bit more about that risk-taking tendency. Is it the excitement, you know, the whole Apple computer, Apple phones, kind of a gee whiz factor? Is that what is at play here?
I think novelty communicates to other people. Like if we're an early adopter of some kind of technology, like the newest Apple iPhone or the newest Tesla car or whatever, then we're communicating to other people that we have access to a new resource. And in persuasion science, we often think about things from an evolutionary perspective. And people, humans, evolved to want to survive and acquire resources. That's how we stay alive. And so we kind of have this shortcut in our brain that tells us that we really value new, exciting resources, and we value people who are able to get them. And like I said earlier, we really value authority figures. The more access and ability people have to acquire new resources, the more authoritative we tend to think they are. And novelty actually attracts our short-term attention. And persuasion is often about being able to attract people's attention and keep it. And when we see something new and novel, like that new iPhone or, you know, the coolest Lululemon outfit, our brains tend to produce more dopamine. And many people know that as the happy drug. It's that really important chemical in persuasion, because we like the feeling when we get that dopamine surge and we tend to want more of it.
So let's translate that into the actual act of persuasion. Are there some key points or key elements that people should keep in mind when they're persuading?
Yes. So if we're talking about novelty, like I said, in order to persuade people, first you have to get their attention and then you have to keep it. There's a difference between our immediate attention, like the attention that we give when someone says our name in a crowded room and we spin around and look for the person, versus the short-term attention, which is the attention we give just long enough to get information or accomplish a goal, and then long-term attention, which is when we really commit to some sort of task. And so you can really persuade people if you move through those three stages of attention. And with novelty, you can grasp people's short-term attention by giving them some sort of easy task to accomplish. And so, for example, if your goal is to get people to get on your website, put down their number and come to your course that you're setting up, then you might be able to give them a little easy task to accomplish and get that dopamine surge if you put up two easy trivia questions that they could answer as soon as they get on your website. And when they click the button and they get that little dopamine surge of winning and completing that task, then they'll be more likely and excited to continue giving you their attention.
So, in other words, it would be counterproductive to engage someone in some sort of, I don't know, political discussion where the topics create polarization in order to get buy-in. We really need to push those pleasure buttons, it sounds like.
Yeah, we really like to engage the shortcuts in our brains. And like I said, we kind of have lazy brain. And when we engage in a political discussion, not only does that create a lot of negative emotion, but it's also really effortful. We have to think of smart things to say and we have to rely on our memories. And that's a kind of a lot of effort. And usually, I don't know about you, but if I'm having a political conversation with someone I disagree with, I don't often end up coming away with it having a lot of positive feelings. And when we want to persuade people, we want them to associate positive feelings and experiences and memories with us. We want to be authoritative, but we also want to be pleasurable and easy to communicate with. And so that's, in order to change people's political opinions, you actually have to engage in like a long-term strategy of persuasion attempts and use subtle psychological tools to change their attitudes over time.
Subtle psychological tools. Could you give us some examples? That sounds very interesting.
Yeah, and they're not mean or scary. They're not coercion. For example, we tend to want to be really consistent in our attitudes and our behaviors. We really like to practice what we preach. So if we ask people to predict their behavior and they say that they will engage in some kind of act like voting, and then we later give them the opportunity to do so, they will be vastly more likely to actually follow through than if we had just asked them to vote in the first place and not asked them to predict their behavior. So we can use this subtle psychological tool called the prediction tactic to get people to follow through and commit to a behavior. A classic study done on this was very interesting. A psychologist named Stephen Sherman asked a group of people whether they would If someone were to ask them to donate their time to solicit donations to the American Cancer Society, most of them said yes, because it's very socially desirable and sounds really great to volunteer our time for the American Cancer Society. And a few weeks later, when an actual representative from the American Cancer Society called these people up, they were 700% more likely to actually spend those 3 hours donating their time and collecting donations than people who were not asked to predict their behavior. So, you know, that's a kind of tactic that we can just use in our conversation with people or our marketing and communication with clients to get them to actually follow through. And from my experiences with my clients, that's something that's really valuable.
700 times. That's amazing.
Percent.
Oh, 700.
Yes, 7 times, 700%.
7 times. Okay. But still, that's pretty huge, especially when it comes to communicating in business and marketing in particular.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. It's remarkable.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about what you're doing. You have a blog, Badassery.
Yeah, Badassery is kind of my pet project. I am constantly inspired by other entrepreneurs I meet in Missoula and elsewhere when I travel. And so I really wanted to create a place to showcase their stories and the ways that they're contributing to our world. For example, my latest feature was on my friend Jennifer Nogin. She lives in Arley outside of Missoula, and she is an accountant by trade, but she actually created a small business called Mountain Meat Shares. And she's a homesteader, and she's really passionate about people knowing where their food comes from and having a relationship with local agriculture. And so she raises her own animals, but she wanted to do this on a larger scale. So she offers subscription boxes of various types of proteins from the Missoula Valley, and families can get their family-sized boxes of subscription meat and eggs and recipes from her. And not only does it reduce their carbon footprint, but they know where their dinner is coming from. And people like Jennifer are really taking these steps to change our world, and that's totally badass. So it's been a great place to meet women like that.
Yeah, I love it. What's the best advice that you have for brands and businesses that want to persuade ethically? We've got like 2 minutes left. No pressure.
Yeah, another big question and a great one. So I meet people all the time who say that they don't want to sound like a pushy salesperson. And I mean, I'm sure that you would agree that you don't like being sold to. Nobody does, because like I said earlier, when we know we're being persuaded, we tend to shut down. So it's like, we never want to give the people the feeling like they just walked on a used car lot and someone's trying to get them to buy a Buick. We want to get people to say yes using subtle psychological tactics and not being coercive, but just giving people the option to say yes. And so if you've ever tried to get better at sales or marketing and you decided to use those aggressive tactics like dominating people or using really high pressure tactics, then my advice is to look for another way to do things, even if you're not ready to invest in learning about persuasion science, because I can't tell you how many people I hear say that they don't like being pressured. Yes. And salespeople can get a really bad rep because mm-hmm. of that. And salespeople often have to spend all their time prospecting for new clients because they burn bridges, and there's mm-hmm. just a smarter way to go about this. And it's persuasion.
Yes, I love it. So very quickly, we're a bit out of time now, but always sad to say, how may people reach you?
So you can reach me at my website, apiscommunicationscience.com, where you can take a free quiz where you can learn the best ways for you to be persuasive in your own life using my signature APIS persuasion algorithm. And that's at APIS, A-P-I-S, communicationscience.com. Or you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at apiscomscience.
Nice. Thank you so much, Micah, for being on Heartstock. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Carol.
Yes.
Thank you.
All righty. This is Heartstock Radio. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week. I'm Carol Murphy. Peace and bye-bye.
the sign it said, no trespass.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5 Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at ButteAmericaRadio.org.